Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, June 26th, T-minus 15 and counting. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, and we're going to be starting today with the first half of the Department of Human Services budget. So I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 5526 related to the Department of Human Services. Ms. Barley.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, as the co-chair just said, this is the first section of parts of the agency to do a work session on. We're planning on doing the rest tomorrow. And if the stuff for tomorrow is not already in the system, it should be out there shortly. So today there are four budget components of the agency we're going to try and work through. The first one of those is program design services. Each of these programs has a document in the OLIS for you to look at. So I'm going to refer to the memo for program design services. So consistent with what I think you saw at the Oregon Health Authority, these memos are laid out with a table that shows the budget history as well as the recommended budget. What you may see odd about program design services is it has a recommended budget of nothing. And that's because as part of the recommendation, this program unit is being disseminated to other programs. So I wanted to start with that so you can understand that some of the dynamic and the recommendations around some of these positions showing up in other parts of the budget as we work through the other programs. So there's a table at the bottom of that memo that shows where positions are going. So currently within that program design services unit, there's a unit that does licensing and regulatory oversight. And I think when you heard from Aging and People with Disabilities and some of the other programs, they talked about a need to push some of these positions back into the program where there's better connectivity with the program staff and some of the policy to try and make that unit work a little more efficiently. So you see positions going back into Aging and People with Disabilities and into Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities programs. Information technology business support. These are positions that are primarily business analysts that work with the programs on their systems, not the pure IT staff that are over in the health authority and the Office of Information Systems, but the people that know the business and help the programs work in those systems, try to figure out how to make modifications or improve systems. Those positions are also being moved back to the programs, with the exception of a centralized core unit is being retained only over in central services to help work on those programs that are, or systems that are cross-program or at the enterprise level in the department. Business intelligence, this unit stays intact, but it moves over to central services. Same thing with program integrity, and moves to central services. So in the new structure, we will have a bigger central services area that has some additional components in it. But I think from a budget perspective and a discussion standpoint, it'll be a little bit more simple. So that table shows that 250 positions move out of those programs into the new, into other program areas. On the second page of the document, you'll see to look at the attachment, which shows the adjustments from current service level. Again, this is a format that's consistent with what we use for Oregon Health Authority. These larger agencies, we deviate from the standard orbits reporting, so we can show you some more detail. The first, lines 1 through 7 are an estimate of the current service level with adjustments that relate to e-board actions in December being carried forward. A portion of those licensing regulatory positions were actually moved in that rebalance action. So some of those move as part of that package structure in the budget recommendations. Then starting on line 9 on down are recommendations in the LFO package. And this is the rest of that reorganization I just talked about, as well as on line 18, a technical adjustment that recentralizes the mass transit expenditures in order to let the agency handle those centrally and more effectively. And then there's also an action that reduces some of the other differential line item to help pay for the centralized abuse management program. Then on the second page of that document, you see the final adjustment from the Legislative Fiscal Office current service level. It shows all the funding being moved out of that program into the other areas, so there's no budget left by the time you're done with the recommendations.
Great.
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to House Senate Bill 5526.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendation to Senate Bill 5526. Senator Gelser, we're just talking about program design services right now. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved.
So the second packet in your materials today is for the central services shared services, state assessments, enterprise-wide costs areas, some of which I've already mentioned. So this, again, in DHS and both Northern Health Authority are centralized areas where we capture the budget for assessments across the state assessments as well as agency-wide assessments. Central services, which is a combination of where the director's office sits as well as some of those other areas I mentioned just previously from programs and services. And shared services, again, are shared services in the Oregon Health Authority. The shared services function is information technology, and in Department of Human Services, a variety of functions, finance, budget, some other areas that are the shared service component on that side. So I would like to just jump to the actual spreadsheet, I think, and for review purposes. That will be simplest. So again, the first section, the first sections, lines 4 and 5, are carry forward of actions that were approved in December 16 rebalance action. There's a position transfer and an adjustment for some other funds for the case management, waiver case management program. Line 6 and 7, package 102 is the ongoing component of an abuse management system that's been under development. That system is slated to be completed and implemented in 2017-19. This package includes a position in shared services to work with training. There's also two positions in the aging and people with disabilities budget for this system that you'll see later on when we do their work session. Under LFO recommended adjustments, again, you're going to see some standardized adjustments across all programs. The mass transit recentralization is a standard adjustment. There's an adjustment on line 11, some repricing of costs that are captured in that assessment program around unemployment insurance and telecom costs. There's a facilities reprojection. That facilities budget is within that central services, statewide assessment program as well. There's an adjustment to enterprise technology services. Again, there was a request to adjust the funding in that program and increase the general fund. This is an increase. It's not as much as the agency requested, but that is an area that the agency continues to need to address in terms of management. Some of those costs are beyond their control as they come from the partner in this service, which is the Department of Administrative Services, but there should be some ability for the agency to work on trying to manage those costs centrally. Line 14. There was a federal rule change that determined that federal funds can no longer be used for performance audits. They can be used for financial audits. But in order to allow the Secretary of State to have an opportunity to do performance audits of the department, there's an increase of general fund built into the budget to pay for those performance audits. The audits aren't free. The agency has to pay for them. Then on lines 15, there's an adjustment for adjustment in shared services, position changes, vacancy savings. Again, you're going to see this across the programs. There's a services supplies reduction built into the budget. On line 18, there are some cap grants in the program. There had been a request to backfill those with general fund. That was not approved as part of this recommendation or in the governor's budget. Oregon Enterprise Data Analytics. This is a new program for a last time. There were 13 positions built in the budget initially. This is a modification that we reduced that capacity down to 9 positions across the two programs. There is some capacity or a part of the program in OHA. It's an adjustment for that. Some position transfers among programs. Line 21 is the DHS portion of the payment that goes with the security positions that went to DAS from OHA. Again, it's a shared service, so there's a DHS funding component. On lines 22 through 25 on that spreadsheet, this again is the rest of that program design services dissemination. These are the pieces that come to central services. And then line 26 includes the elimination of 16 vacant positions, and those are across some of those shared and central services functions. One thing I wanted to point out is in your packet, there's some discussion around the integrated eligibility, Medicaid eligibility project that you had a couple of hearings on. None of those recommendations are included in this recommendation or in this or in Senate Bill 5526. That big project includes a bonding component that's still being sorted out in terms of all the statewide bonding projects. If that ends up getting dealt with in that project, you would see that in a later budget action. What I want you to know is that there is an attachment to the memo that's the feedback from the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Technology. They reviewed the project and then transmitted a recommendation to your committee and to the Big Ways and Means Committee. Or the full committee, the recommendation basically says, as far as the project, It's okay to proceed, but with caution and with a lot of oversight. And there's like three pages of oversight, bullets, and components that go with that recommendation.
With that, Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to Senate Bill 5526.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendation to Senate Bill 5526. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, sorry.
I'm opposed.
Representative Buehler is opposed. Thank you. Okay, so moved.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, the next memo in your packet is for vocational rehabilitation. This program is one of the smaller programs in the department, and I'll try to, where I can, reference maybe some of the discussions we've had around reductions and some of maybe perhaps the co-chair framework. I think in the co-chair framework that was published for this program, there was a reduction of 21 positions. That action is not included in this plan. There's utilization of some what should be available federal reallotment dollars to help offset some general fund one-time fund shift in this budget. There's an elimination of two long-term vacant positions. There's enough general fund maintained in this program to meet federal maintenance of effort requirements and hopefully keep the program out of order of selection. Again, that order of selection is something that can change based on caseload and workload, and the agency will continue to let you know how they're doing with regard to that potential order action. So on your spreadsheet, again, there's a keying error back on line 5 that was from budget development that's being fixed. These were positions that actually belonged in voc rehab that were in voc rehab, and the current biennium got inadvertently shifted to intellectual development disabilities in the budget development process. That's been corrected. Mass transit vacancy, SNS, and then again the use of the federal allotment dollars and the elimination of two long-time vacant positions.
All right, Madam Chair, move the LFO recommendations to Senate Bill 5526.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendations to Senate Bill 5526. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Representative Buehler. Thank you. Did you have discussion or just opposition?
Just opposition.
Thank you. So moved. All right.
Then the last portion of the DHS budget for you to look at today is the self-sufficiency program. I'll walk through the memo on this one. So you will see that the LFO recommendation, if you look at total funds, is below the current service level, primarily because there has been some caseload savings and decreased costs in the program that allow about $60 million in general fund to be freed up from prior estimates. The temporary assistance for needed families caseload, average caseload projection for 17-19 decreased by about 3,000 families between the fall 2016 forecast and the spring 2017 forecast. I think when they gave you the caseload update a few weeks ago, you saw some of the trends in that program continuing to decline into the next biennium. I would say that recent updates to actual show that downward trend continues, but the caseload is still is a little bit higher than what was anticipated in that spring forecast. So that may be an area that we have additional discussion on as we move into the biennium, probably in the fall or in next January. The agency will bring forward a rebalance for discussion, and we can talk about caseload changes at that time. The second bullet on the first page of the memo, there is a reduction in general fund capacity in the employment-related daycare program. That equates to about 650 cases. The program is, there's general fund being pulled out of the program, as well as there was a base adjustment from Child Care Development Fund dollars. There's not as much federal money available to shift over to the employment-related daycare program. There are more requirements over in early learning about the use of those funds. There were some federal changes in the program that require some things to be done differently. So overall, between the adjustments in general fund, use of some one-time CCF carry forward to help backfill some of that, it looks like the caseload should be able to be supported at about 8,900 cases for 17-19. That is lower than was originally budgeted in 15-17. It's also lower than what would have built into a current service level. However, for context, I think I looked at the most recent actuals for ERDC, and we were running at 8,500 cases in May of 17 actuals. So as far as what we're actually doing in the program and the capacity, I think that's actually in alignment and actually a little bit higher than what's currently operating at. Then the second, on the other page, the next page, there's a couple of pieces that move to the program from Early Learning Division. One of those is an alcohol and drug child care program. This program was previously funded with Child Care Development Fund money. It's an intermittent, more of a drop-in type program for child care, and under the new federal rules, which is about more consistent 12-month eligibility, a little bit more consistent approach to childcare, that determine or early learning is indicating that those funds are no longer available to support that program. The program's being moved, no funding's coming with it. You'll see a budget note in the final action that relates to this, that Department of Human Services is gonna review the participants in this program. Some of them are already touching some other DHS programs, and I believe they think there's a way to go ahead and serve these families, but they'll have to do some work, and they'll come back and report in November on how that looks. The actual transition of the program would occur in January of 2018. Then the last bullet, another adjustment or policy change is that the budget plan for this programming does include savings of $3.4 million general fund. This relates to the non-needy caretaker relative income being counted as part of the grant now. That will affect some families. It will either reduce or potentially eliminate the grant for some families or families where the non-needy caretaker in the household group's income was not being counted as part of the eligibility for TANF. If you remember, there were some other TANF reductions initially laid on some of the other reduction lists that included changing time limits and removing a lot more families from the program. So I would say that this final plan is a lot more limited than what we had earlier.
Yeah, pleased about that. Okay.
Discussion?
I'll go ahead and make the motion, and you can do the discussion. Feel free.
So, Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to Senate Bill 5526.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendation to Senate Bill 5526. Discussion. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So, I'm concerned about the self-sufficiency budget. One thing that is, I believe, still in it is that we are pushing the reduction in caseloads by counting the Social Security income, where we haven't counted
no,
that before.
We're have not we, anymore.
Have we gotten that out?
That's out.
Okay. So, good. So, the other thing that I have concerned with this budget is that the ERDC funding mechanism, the way that they use the community 75% process, ends up, I think, in disproportional funding mechanism towards metropolitan areas that have the highest funding in the nation for our child care, where the rural areas don't. They get funded between 50 cents on the dollar and 33 cents on the dollar to provide the same service. So I think this is a concern that has been very difficult to kind of peel the curtain back on. I will keep working on it, and I think there needs to be some balancing in the ERDC program.
Thank you. I appreciate the heads up about that, and I'll be interested to learn more as you get more information on it. Thank you. Senator Gilster?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank everyone that put the work into these budgets. I think Senator Winters really named it well. These are not easy budgets to put together, given the revenue that we have. So this is not a criticism in any way, but I just want to acknowledge that these are real changes that will impact about 1,800 families in terms of regarding the income of non-needy relative caregivers that could impact the number of kids that are going into child welfare. It is one of the reasons why I had so strongly hoped that we could come forward with more revenue this session. I know that we spent a lot of time in the building talking about the education budget, which is incredibly important, but the reductions in the needs in human services are tremendous, and over the next 2 days we're going to hear that a lot in self-sufficiency and child welfare and developmental disabilities and aging and people with disabilities. And it's really important that we acknowledge that and recognize that what we need in human services isn't just in the long run, if we were going to do human services the right way, isn't just an avoiding of cuts. It's a real need for real investment, especially investment on the front end of prevention that in the long run would save us some money. But until we get to a place where we can restructure our revenue system, we're going to continue to hobble along, and real Oregon families and kids are going to struggle with that. So thanks to all of the DHS folks that work very hard to meet the standards that we set for you when we give you inadequate resources to do that. And I hope that we can come back in 2019 and really start to build the revenue structure that would be required for the Department of Human Services to provide the quality and consistency of services that Oregonians demand and hold them accountable for, even though we're not willing to buy it.
Thank you. And I think it's fair to say that, speaking for my co-chair and myself, This is, as Senator Gelser quite rightly pointed out, not the easiest budget in the world. Thank you. And then speaking only for myself, I can say it kept me awake a fair number of nights, and it's less worse than it could have been, thanks to a lot of hard work by a lot of people, but it's not pretty. Representative Bueller?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Co-chair. I appreciate the work you've put into it. I know it's difficult. My concern is that there's going to be more difficulties in these budgets because we haven't got the overall cost structure of the state controlled to an extent that it's going to match our revenue stream, no matter if we increase taxes or not. And we're going to be right back here again in 2 years with very difficult and similar budgets.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any further discussion? Is there opposition to the motion? Representative Hayden, Representative Bueller. Okay, motion carries. Okay, I think that's it for 5526 for today. Can I close this work session? Yeah, or do you carry it over?
Okay. We'll open a new one tomorrow.
Okay, I'm closing the work session on 50. Yeah. So, just so people are aware, as we move to the next part, which is around bills, because things are in a lot of flux right now and things are changing, we're going to be, for each of them, we'll just open a public hearing first, close the public hearing, and then move to the work session when we're ready. I do want to stand at ease for 1 minute, Eric, if we could. And
Did you get copies of the opinion on this one?
Okay, we're back on 2834.
No, 2661.
No.
DSP.
Okay, so Representative Kenny Geyer is here. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2661. Ms. A. Byerly? What? I'm sorry.
Hi. Who's first and last?
Okay. What were you going to say?
I don't know.
Okay.
We're on 2661.
Okay. So, Ms. Byerly, you want to talk to us about 2661, please?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. Maybe. This is a bill that would establish a new regulatory or information gathering structure for some long-term care referral providers. These are providers that provide assistance to people who are seeking out long-term care settings for their loved ones. And there really is no structure in place right now to kind of monitor the organizations in the state. So this is an attempt to kind of get that going. In your packet, you've got information on the bill. There is a fiscal impact and the recommended amendment to the bill, and does include some funding for that. I think there's a little bit of concern about the fiscal and potential roll-up costs going forward, but part of the issue is this is really sort of an uncertain environment. We don't really know how many participants are going to be, what that work is going to look like. So I would characterize this as something that will be a work in progress going forward for both the agency and the legislature to kind of fine-tune the rules around this program.
Great. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Hi. Thank you for having us here. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer from House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland, and I've really been honored to work on this bill. You may know that the Human Services Committee on the Senate side really took up the foster care issue and took the lead on that, and our committee on the House side focused a little bit more. We did some on that, but focused more on the other end of the spectrum, and part of that entailed this legislation, as well as looking at increasing quality of long-term care facilities. So these are the agents that refer people to the long-term care facilities. It's a very important role. You're dealing with people at a time in their life when they're very vulnerable seniors. They're looking at leaving their home and having to go to some kind of facility, and they need assistance in figuring out what's the right level of facility and what's a good match. There are different business models out there. And in the beginning, we had some contention between the different kinds of models, and the purpose of this legislation was not to favor one kind of model over another. My personal belief is that it's very important to be able to have a variety of business models out there, but to make sure that all of them have some kind of quality control and consumer protection. So the main different kinds of agencies that are out there, you've got the internet agencies like Caring.com and A Place for a Mom, who people will call, they'll see advertisements, they'll call, and they make referrals that way. They give a list of possible facilities. And then the other way is what we call boots on the ground. These are long-term care agents who actually take people to the different facilities. They meet the people who are about to move, and they know the facilities. So two very different models, and can meet very different kinds of needs for people. So what we wanted to do is make sure that for any kind of model out there, we really had very clear quality control, because we also know that there's some kind of fly-by-night and really fraudulent groups out there, and again, we're dealing with very vulnerable seniors. So the main things that this bill does is, number one, it creates disclosures. A lot of people don't realize that the way that long-term care referral agents are normally paid as they get a referral fee from a facility, and sometimes there are contracts between the long-term agents and the facilities that say anytime a client is referred to a facility, that facility plays a long-term care agent. And sometimes that is the case for up to 2 years. And so we wanted to make sure that there was a strong disclosure done in conspicuous, clear language, could be made orally if recorded, and thereafter a written copy would be sent, that would include the length of the contract a referral agency has with the facility, the referral agent's contact information, their privacy policy, who would get the information on that, and a statement about how the referral agent is paid. So that was the number one piece. The second that we did was say, if you have already been referred to a facility and you're at a facility and you want to move to a different facility, that you would have the right with written notification to get out of having your referral agent in that contract with a facility. So in other words, if you want to choose a different referral agent, you would have an opportunity. We call it the one and done policy. We looked at a lot of different ones. This is the most modest change from what we have. Some people really advocated for a right to rescind, like realtors have, where you can, if you want out, you want out, even if you haven't been referred to anything yet. But we decided to take a very modest move and just do after the first referral, then you had the right to get out of that, be referred to another agency, another facility, and have a different agent pay you. So that's the right to work with another referral agent after the first placement. Third thing is no self-dealing. So we want to make sure that referral agents who are being paid are not, for instance, referring to maybe their husband who has an adult foster care home, something like that. So that's a really important piece of this legislation. Fourth, we wanted mandatory reporting. reporting so that if you see something going on, whether you're boots on the ground or whether you're even an internet company and you hear something happening on the phone, that they need to be mandatory reporters because this is a very vulnerable population. And then fifth, through a registration program with DHS. And again, we looked at how do we keep it as lean as possible, not licensing, not certification, but simple registration. Through that, we would have background checks. We would require $1 million in liability insurance. And one of the biggest advantages of doing registration at all is that we would know who these players are. AARP and Alzheimer's have been doing a lot of work to do trainings on how do you recognize signs of Alzheimer's. And if you have referral agents that are out there trying to refer to the appropriate level of care, it would be really good to connect them in with a lot of the training that AARP and Alzheimer's Association is developing. So that having a registration and knowing who's out there could do that. I want to say one thing about the fiscal. I had a conversation with Senator Steiner Hayward on the phone Friday, not having seen this fiscal. My understanding is that the goal was that there would be some startup costs that we would need some modest general funds for. It's $57,000 in this biennium. And that in future bienniums, the fee would pay. We're increasing the fee from $200 to $750 because we want this to be a self-sustaining program. My understanding is that DHS wanted a .25 and a .25 of the two different kinds of positions to total a .5. That would have brought the entire program to about $120,000. $56,000 would come from fees. I mean, maybe more if there are more agencies out there, but we don't know. That would leave $64,000, and the agency wanted to absorb that. My understanding is that in the formulas that LFO uses, that wasn't possible, but there is a recognition from LFO that we won't know the total cost until we start putting it in place. And so there's some flexibility to come back next year and look. But I want to reiterate, and we've got Mike McCormick from DHS, who is the one that submitted a lot of the numbers here, who you can bring up if you'd like. The intention is not to come anywhere close to this in the second biennium.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Steele, why don't we hear from you, and then people can ask the two of you questions.
Yeah, wonderful. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Fred Steele. I'm the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and as this committee is particularly aware of and familiar with our program and what the Long-Term Care Ombudsman does, that we advocate for individuals in long-term care facilities, the exact facilities that these referrals are being made to for the individuals in that are looking for placements. Frequently for their new home, if not just for care that they're going to receive potentially long term. Our focus is on the dignity, independence, and rights of the individuals. And it's on the rights of individuals before they're moving into facilities that is just as important and that this bill is dealing with and addressing. Our concern is that there are individuals that are looking for placement. Oftentimes in a period of turmoil in their life. I mean, they're in an emergency room. They're in the hospital. They need long-term care, and they start looking for placement. You know, where do you go? There's over 600 facilities in Oregon and throughout Oregon, especially if you're in a populated area, many, many facilities to choose from. And these senior referral agents do provide a wonderful service. You have your online versions and your local versions. The concern for us really resides in the area of, as I kind of frame it, that there are two contracts being made by with the referral agents, one with the individual or the family member, and then one with the facility. And it's those contracts that end up competing with each other, as I see it, or creating a potential conflict for the senior referral agent. Generally, these services are advertised as free to the individual, except that who's paying that? And I don't think enough individuals actually ask who's paying this fee, who's paying the fee that frequently is as much as 1 month of care provided in a care facility, so anywhere from $4,000 to maybe $7,000. And I don't know the specific fees, but I've heard many, many times that that's where the fees are at, is in that $4,000 to $7,000 range. To me, there's an inherent conflict there. It's an obvious conflict that who is that senior referral agent going to be serving? Are they going to be serving the individual that's, you know, the facility, the provider that's going to pay them, that's looking to fill beds so that they can keep their monthly income coming in? Or are they going to be actually recognizing the needs of the individual that needs long-term care? Are they going to be looking for the right placement that's a safe place that doesn't have a long track record of, unfortunately, and does happen at times, of abuse or licensing violations? Are they going to be looking for a place that can do proper care planning for that individual with their significant needs? Dementia is a great example. With 60-plus different types of dementias, I've learned from the Alzheimer's Association, there are different facilities and memory care facilities that treat dementias in different ways. They have different supports, either with the different staff that they have, the different activities, definitely the different abilities to address some of the more aggressive behavior dementias. This bill doesn't create, as the representative said, doesn't create a heavy-handed regulatory approach. In fact, it's very much just taking an approach of shedding some light on an industry that ideally will create considerable consumer protections for seniors looking for their care placements. So looking at the disclosures, that's going to be a huge step forward so that seniors know that there is this secondary contract that's at play, that, you know, where are the fees coming from, and making sure that they're getting the service that they need. We have concerns about, and we've had concerns, as I've learned in the last year and a half, about the two-year kind of process to that we've seen with the online companies. But for an individual that goes online, checks a box, and then all of a sudden their name is now owned for the next 2 years without even knowing that has occurred. The problem is, of course, is, okay, they've lived in a place for 6 months, they want to move, they maybe didn't care for the service they received from the online company the last time, or maybe they did and they just want to try out a new a local senior referral agent. Well, that local agent, if they realize that there's this two-year ownership in play, that they're not going to be able to get paid, the senior referral agent won't get paid, so they're not going to provide the service. And that, to me, is a significant cost to the individual, even if they're not paying upfront for the service, that they will lose the ability to contract with a local senior referral agent, or lose the ability to choose facilities that local senior referral agent may want to refer them to. So just wanted to touch on those different aspects as we see it as the long-term care ombudsman for the rights of individuals that are looking for placement, the consumer protection aspects of the bill. So touching on the important aspects of disclosures and the registration, we see as a huge improvement, even though it is just a kind of a light approach, arguably, but a huge improvement, a huge step forward for seniors.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Yeah, Senator Winters.
What estimate, or do you have an estimate of approximately how many agents are we talking about?
We think between 60 and 75.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you both very much.
And I do just want to say that we met every single week, mostly at the Department of Justice, with Cheryl Hiemstra, who will be the last one to answer any questions, specifics. She's from the Department of Justice, so that was really helpful to have her support, as well as Erica Hoover from my staff.
Thank you very much. All right, we've got a few people signed up to testify. Nels Johnson, Jennifer Cook Berman, Hope Blumen, hope I got that right. And then I'll bring up one other panel, and then Ms. Hiemstra. I'm going to remind the I don't see Jennifer. Are you coming? Okay. I'm going to remind folks as you testify, while it's important for us to understand the policy, we also have two other bills to hear today. So if you could focus on things that haven't been said already, that points you want to bring up, I'd be grateful, so we can be sure to get everybody heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. My name is Nels Johnson. I'm here on behalf of Caring.com today. Just real quick as a reference, Caring.com is a long-term care referral service, and it operates similar to how Expedia does. The thought is it saves you time and money. You tell them, price points, dietary restrictions, things like that, and then it's enters it into an algorithm, and then kicks out usually 3 to 4 referrals for you as a consumer to then go and investigate, and then go decide if those are actually right fit for you. So I want to say that we really appreciate a lot of the good work that's gone into this, but we do have one concern that I wanted to address today, and namely that is the fiscal impact statements, and as it pertains to the implementation of the program. Earlier this year, California considered a very similar bill that would regulate the long-term care referral industry, and they put a fiscal impact of $7 million. Now, of course, California is eight times as big, and so, of course, you know, a program on an organ is not going to cost anywhere near that, but even if you take one-eighth of that cost, that still is $850,000 rather than the $140,000 to $393,000 projected by DHS. These numbers matter, and we're concerned that two part-time FTE may not be enough to actually run this program, and then that could lead to some compliance issues and other and complaints not being investigated and things like that. So it's worth noting that there is not actual data on the number of private referral agents or the number of referrals made, and so this bill, what it would do is it would put the following new workload on DHS: to identify the referral agents, to monitor compliance of all employees as mandatory reporters, to verify that all employees are trained in laws, regulations, and policies, monitor and audit compliance with fee and other disclosure requirements, monitor and audit with the recording consent requirements, with information sharing requirements, fee arrangements, and several other things, including an administrative rules process and technical assistance for businesses. And so we just, our concern is that there may not be enough staff, and what you may end up doing is creating a program that, though well-intentioned, is underfunded and doesn't work the way that it was designed to do. So we just ask the committee to think about that as you deliberate. So thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Cook Buman, and I am...
I apologize for mispronouncing.
That was good. Human with a B.
Got it. Thank you.
I am a business owner of Living Right Senior Placement in my 10th year of business, and a member of the Oregon Senior Referral Agency Association, which was established in 2004 to create some... basic standards of practice and a set of bylaws and a code of ethics. There are several members of that association in the audience here today. The lack of oversight and standards of practice in this industry when you're working with very vulnerable adults, it was shocking to me when I entered the industry 10 years ago. So working together as we consider ourselves co-competitors to establish just some good practices statewide. To be a member of OSRA, we call it OSRA, we do run criminal background checks, and people with felonies are not allowed to be members. We do require liability insurance of our members. And we have a complaint process in our bylaws as well. If any, either a family or a facility has a complaint on the way any of us are doing, our practices, we are boots on the ground people, as Representative Kenny Geyer explained. I'm not quite sure where Caring.com is coming up with their monitor and audit costs that are proposed, because this is a very, very light touch of regulation. The way it's written, the California bill was provided a tremendous amount more oversight and requirements in its bill, and that is where we began with this bill. It has been significantly diluted to welcome and include the internet-based companies. So, I think that probably covers the majority of my points.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I have one. Representative Kenny Geyer estimated 65 to 75 agencies. Does that tally with your sense, leaving the internet ones aside for the moment, does that tally with your guesstimate based on your
organization? Internet aside, we have a distribution list for our trainings, because we do two annual trainings a year. Our distribution list is around 60.
Okay, great. And do you think that there are a significant number of independent agencies in Oregon that are not part of your organization?
I do.
You do?
I do.
Okay.
That list encompasses those that we believe are.
Oh, so your organization has how many members?
Organization has approximately 25 to 30 members at the moment. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly, most of us are in the Portland metro area with a couple of representatives in Salem, Grants Pass, and Bend.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, Petronella Donovan, I hope that's an N. No, it's not. It's W, maybe. I'm not doing well reading names. And Mr. Eames, come on up. I apologize for names today, people. Go ahead, please.
Well, my name is real easy. I don't know how Petronella is so hard.
Petronella's easy. Petronella's easy. It's the last part because I couldn't read the last letter of your last name.
Oh,
that was the part that I couldn't get. The Petronella I got.
Awesome, awesome. Well, good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. I am actually representing the independent.
You actually state your name.
Oh, so sorry. Petronella Donovan.
Okay, thank you. Wasn't in. All right, good.
And so I'm representing the Independent Adult Care Home Association. I am the president for that association. I am also a provider. I have an adult care home as well. And I just wanted to add our support for this bill. We've actually worked on the other side where we actually work with these placement agencies and saw their effects on how they work out there in the real world. A lot of these placement agencies, I mean, anybody can open a placement agency. I can open it in my living room if I wanted to. Pick up the phone and call my three best friends and say, do you have a vacancy? I got somebody for you. What I've seen is like Fred Steele said here a moment ago, we are working with vulnerable adults here. These placement agencies don't have the training, and a lot of the times to not only dementia, but we take care of very high acuity patients in our adult care homes. So what I'm advocating for is that we do have some kind of oversight. A lot of the times we get a phone call and say, do you have a vacancy? Not much about the patient. And because it's a turmoil when the family members are actually looking for a place to put their loved one in, we will accept them just because we have a vacancy. And then we turn around and say, oh my goodness, you know, we can't take care of this person. So what goes next? We have to pay the agency, you know, whatever that amount is. And sometimes it's more than, you know, a full month's of fees. To the agency where we don't even get the proper amount of, if you want to call it, assessment about the resident. So that's very scary. I do think that the placement agencies that don't know enough about us are the work we do. It's just, I call it selling of names. I mean, I think the majority of the points were addressed here. I think they need to have a background check, like we all have to do. I think that liability insurance, absolutely. We get charged even for Medicaid placement in our adult care homes, which is unfair for the provider. So in broad sense, I think that, the issues were addressed. If there's any questions specifically, I'm from the provider's side, and I can absolutely answer those questions.
Thank you so much. We'll hear from Mr. Eames first, and then we can ask questions of both of you. Mr. Eames.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of A Place for Mom, similar to Caring.com, an internet-based senior living referral agency. This has been quite a long trip to get to this point with a lot of meetings and a lot of discussion, a lot of compromise on both sides. And so we want to, first of all, thank Representative Kenny Geyer, the Department of Justice, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office, for participating so much on this bill and really working to try to find a good piece of legislation. I would say that this bill really does further transparency in the senior living referral space. It adds some regulations and some oversight to and otherwise what was not regulated in industry. And so we think, all in all, the bill is a good bill and should be passed. There are still some concerns with the bill, but nothing that is so much that would supersede our support of the bill, because there are a number of good things in this bill. I also want to thank the providers that brought this forward and their willingness to work with groups like A Place for Mom to craft a better bill. So we hope and encourage you to pass the bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you both very much. Ms. Heemstra.
Good morning. Co-Chair Senator Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. Again, thanking all the groups involved on this bill. It was a long journey. And a special thank to OCA. They were quite involved as well. Just want to mention a few things about the enforcement, the compliance. I'm not terribly familiar with the California bill, but knowing California, I'm guessing it was quite regulatory and detailed. We took, as you've heard, a much lighter approach here. DHS is simply going to do a registry, so not licensing, not certification, just gathering the names and getting a list together, making sure of some very simple things, the insurance, the background checks, and collect the fee. As far as the enforcement goes, the Department of Justice will be enforcing this as well, especially the disclosure pieces. So we'll be helping that out, and we are able to recover our investigatory costs and so forth, which is why we do not have a fiscal impact on the bill. And we'll be able to help out in that area. I would commend to you the Dash 11 amendments. They put in the money as well as fixed some last-minute technical fixes that we worked out with industry. So again, thank you for your consideration today, and I am happy to mention any questions or answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Heemstra? Okay, great. So I think we're through everybody on the list. I'm going to close the public hearing. It sounds as if this one is ready to rock and roll, so I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2661. Ms. Byerly?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, there is a memo on OLIS for you today. The LFO recommendation is to adopt the A-A11 amendment, which is the -A10 amendment plus expenditure authority for the agency. And again, I think most of you know that LFO is always looking for other sources of revenue to pay for something instead of general fund. So if it turns out that the fees do great things, we'll make sure we adjust that going forward with the budget.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the -A11 amendment to House Bill 2661.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the -A11 to House Bill 2661. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2661 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves House Bill 2661 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? If not, so moved. Okay, we need carriers. Senator Winters, would you be kind enough to carry us the full? Representative Kenny Garr, I'll carry it in the House. Senator Gelser, you want to take this one in the Senate?
Sure.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2661 and opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 942 related to child safety. Mm-hmm. You want to get us started, Ms. Byerly? You're going to testify?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, again, you have information on Senate Bill 942 in the system today. This is a bill that relates to some actions that the Department of Human Services must take when investigating child abuse. The bill that's out in OLIS does have a fiscal impact. It's related primarily to and a requirement that the agency conduct certain exit interviews with children. The amendment that's in OLIS today removes that requirement, which basically makes the fiscal non-existent or not.
Okay. Senator Gelser, you want to get us up to speed on this bill, please?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm a state senator from Corvallis and Albany, Senate District 8, and chair of the Human Services Committee on the Senate side. Senate Bill 942, in its original form as it came to you, did two things. One, it implemented one of the recommendations of the public knowledge group that met. It was the external review of the child welfare program in order to improve foster youth voice in the system, and it would have ensured that kids are asked after they have left a placement how it worked, what was great, what wasn't so great. We have removed that because there was a fiscal put on it by the department. My hope is that the department will be able to move forward to that and add that in the interim without legislation because it really is just
talking to young people about how their foster placement was, and hopefully our caseworkers are talking to our foster youth. The key part of Senate Bill 942, however, looks at how we are doing assessments across the state, including in the parts of the state that are doing differential response. You may recall that there was a lot of attention to the issue of differential response earlier this session when we heard this bill and when a report was released, and the department did pause the expansion of differential response. Senate Bill 942 does not stop differential response. It will not increase the number of reports of child abuse. It simply says that when the department receives a report of abuse or neglect and there is enough concern that it is assigned for an assessment, and a comprehensive assessment is done, because the department has told us that for both alternative response and traditional response cases, the same child abuse assessment is done. At the end of that, into the record will be entered whether that was founded or unfounded for abuse. This is important for a couple of reasons. One, it will ensure that we are completing these on time. Makes us go through the same process for both traditional and alternative response cases. We know that right now our alternative response cases are often very delayed, both in terms of the initial contact with the child and the completion of the assessment. The second thing is that it is incredibly important for our data. When we talked about the issues of differential response and how safe it is in Oregon earlier this year, we heard a lot about how kids in DR counties and non-DR counties are equally safe. The problem is we don't really know that, because when we don't enter the disposition into our history, we really can't compare the number of founded allegations of abuse in a DR county versus a non-DR county, because it might be the third or fourth founded allegation of abuse before that is actually recorded as a founded abuse. The best way to look at that is if tomorrow we decided we were never going to do dispositions on any child abuse assessment, we could say next month that we have no child abuse in Oregon. That's just a matter of what it is that we're entering into the computer. So at the end of the day, all Senate Bill 942 does is state that until the department meets certain milestones at the end of the assessment that it is already being done, the worker will enter into the record whether that is a founded or unfounded assessment. The milestones that the department needs to meet before they can stop doing those are having adequate staffing at their workload model, demonstrating timely initial contact after a report of abuse, timely completion of comprehensive assessments across the state, getting our reabuse rate below the national average. Right now, both our reabuse rate and our rate of abuse of kids in care is above the national average, and the implementation of our statewide centralized child abuse hotline, which the department is in the process of putting together now. It's an important bill for child safety. We've worked pretty hard on it in the policy committee, and I really urge your support of the measure.
Thank you. Question for Senator Gelser? I don't have a question, but thank you, because probably one of the issues that drives most of us crazy are the issue of child abuse in this state. And so this is just telling the agency what they should be doing anyway. Thank you, Senator Gelser. And at one point, I would hope that we no longer will have to have these conversations about abuse and neglect in the state of Oregon. It's outrageous. And reading the paper this morning, not only that abuse, the whole daycare issue that was front page in my paper, I think it was yesterday. And, you know, how we treat the most vulnerable in our society is also what happens with the decay of our society. Just have to say for the record.
And Madam Chair, Senator Winters, with that daycare issue, it's important to remember that DHS is tasked with doing those child abuse investigations for daycares, and we've worked with the Early Learning Division over the course of the past year on some of these issues. They cannot take action on a license if they don't have a completed, founded assessment from the department, and that's why the screening and the assessment process is so important in family homes, in foster care, and in child care facilities.
Thank you. Representative Bueller?
Thank you, Co-Chair. I greatly appreciate your work on this issue, and I'm very passionate about it myself. I would appeal to the members of the committee, though, that despite good work like this, we're not getting to the root cause of many of the kids that are being abused and entering into the foster care system, and that's the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. And we have yet this session to pass a meaningful bill to deal with this crisis. That's available to us. It's not moving, and we should increasingly focus on root causes of these problems than dealing with the symptoms. I'd appeal for efforts in that regard.
Thank you. I'll just agree with him and put another plug for 2518, which is a bill that's important to both Representative Buehler and myself and that I've been trying hard to get moving. Okay, any other questions? I don't have anybody else signed up to testify on this bill. Is there anybody else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 942? Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 942 and open a work session on Senate Bill 942. Ms. Byerly?
Madam Co-Chair, as I said previously, the LFO recommendation is to adopt the A-3 amendment, which removes the fiscal impact.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair?
Madam Chair, I move the -A3 amendment to Senate Bill 942.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves the -A3 amendment to Senate Bill 942. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 942 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves Senate Bill 942 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended by the -3. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? If not, so moved. Senator Winters to full, Senator Gelsler to the Senate floor. Somebody want to take this? Representative Buehler, you want to take this on the House floor?
Sure.
Thank you. Okay. Yep. I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 942. And just to be clear, and Representative Hayden knows this already, we're not going to be holding a work session. We will have a public hearing, which I'm about to open on House Bill 2834 today. There's still some technical issues. So I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2834 relating to health care, and we have a new colleague joining us who hasn't been in our committee before. Do you want to introduce yourself to the committee?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Co-Chairs Meg Bushman Weinhold with LFO.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, this bill actually requires dentists that have a contract with a coordinated care organization, dental care organizations under contract with a coordinated care organization, to provide oral health care services to low-income seniors and veterans residing in the geographic area served by the dental care organization if those low-income seniors and veterans are not otherwise covered for oral health care by medical assistance program, employer-sponsored health insurance, or the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Under consideration.
We do have a recommended amendment, which is the -A10, which would require a health benefit plan to cover osteopathic manipulative treatment, also cover the evaluation that leads to that treatment.
Thank you. And to clarify, that was a bill that made it through the Senate and potentially accidentally missed in the House. So we're just having this opportunity to bring it back in. Representative Hayden, nice to see you on that side.
Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative for House District 7. Today I'd like to talk a little bit about a pair of bills, but House Bill 2834, the background to that, tied a little bit with House Bill 2979, I think it is, that isn't currently moving. So the background of these bills started in 2015. With an effort in coordination with OHA to bring dual eligible people into the CCO model or the coordinated care model, meaning that if somebody qualified that was a veteran or a senior under Medicaid, they got services through the fee-for-service, and we wanted to be able to get them into CCO models. So there was a lot of people that worked on getting a solution to that. And if you look on the meeting materials that I've provided for you, there's a couple of bullet points that I want to talk about. But we were successful. OHA was successful in the transformation, the health system transformation on page 21 of those meeting materials, and that's a 390-page document. I did not put all of that on there, but if anybody would like to read through that, this is basically the 1115 waiver that we worked on in 2015-2016. The waiver does allow for some transformation, continued healthcare transformation that would bring these populations in and allow them Medicaid and Medicare to be assigned to a CCO. So that's kind of the background of these bills. As we've moved forward in that process, it looks like there might be the opportunity for the veterans and the seniors to move forward. The other bill that I mentioned tackled the issue of not getting members onto a CCO quick enough, meaning that we have about 150,000 members languishing, up to 180,000 members on the fee-for-service. Again, on the meeting materials in OLIS, if you look at page 21 of the 390-page document that was approved on January 12th of this year, we, meaning OHA, in the transformation under item 23AI1, new members not choosing a plan will be auto-enrolled or auto-assigned to a CCO through an auto-enrollment process if capacity exists. We have heard in healthcare, in Ways and Means, and other places over and over and over that OHA is not allowed to auto-enroll members from the fee-for-service into CCOs yet. In our own 1115 waiver that we requested, that is what we say we're going to do. So it's been a very frustrating process going through, knowing that we have seniors and veterans, folks out there, particularly in oral health, there is a lack of the ability to provide capacity in the fee-for-service. We have a company called KeyPro that is assigned to connect people with services. Until last year, they didn't even do anything with oral health. It was like they weren't even aware that oral health was out there. So honestly, it's been a pretty frustrating process to go through that. But I am excited that 2834 has some breath left in it and moving forward. Recently, as of the last couple of days, it has come up with what is the funding mechanism for this. So as this bill got approval and was allowed to move through just the regular House Healthcare Committee, the discussions were that the funding would be an appropriation from the general fund to fund this population in conjunction with a couple of things on OLIS. I've also put on there just the explanatory statement on Measure 96. I worked with a lot of people on this bill, including the Oregon Department of Veterans Administration, Cameron Smith, who is willing to have the discussion of having the Veterans Administration be involved in that funding if Measure 96 is fully funded. And so the funding mechanism on the policy was not written into this policy, because at the time that this was going through several months ago, we didn't know. I mean, we had proposals from the governor's office. We had proposals, budgetary proposals from the Ways and Means co-chairs. And so Oregon Department of Veterans Administration is very excited about getting oral health services for the veterans. Historically, veterans don't have oral health services because it's not service-connected. So a lot of times we think, well, if you're in the VA, you have health services. You mostly don't have oral health services. As far as the Medicaid itself, again, Medicaid doesn't have oral health services, so that would be a general fund appropriation liability and some combination of it. In addition, the last item that I wanted to present, and this again is very difficult to kind of pull the curtain back on OHA, but I have included it for you, and this is just for conceptual purposes only. The hospitals and the CCOs do receive transformation pool funding. The hospital transformation pool funding is still $180 million left from the original, what we call the $1.9 billion out there. I'm not suggesting that these funds go towards funding 2834. I'm also not suggesting that the incentive pool funds of the CCOs, which adds up to about $400 million over the next biennium, that they get to spend on some very important things. But I would like to point out that it has been very difficult to figure out exactly what happens with that funding. I have asked repeatedly of OHA, can you please tell me where that funding is spent? And they said, basically, we get a feedback loop from the CCOs of what they spend that money on. But So far, they have been unwilling to give me that information. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Let me clarify one thing you just said. So the basic impetus behind this bill, if I am understanding you correctly, is that historically, veterans and dual eligibles, elderly people who are both on Medicare and by virtue of their low incomes are on Medicaid, have been in an opt-in situation for CCOs, which is to say that they're automatically put into fee-for-service and they choose to opt into a CCO, then they can be at one, right? But if that were not the case, if they were switched to opt out and they were automatically put into CCOs, as opposed, and then they would have to opt out to go into fee-for-service, would that obviate the need for this bill? I'm not trying to kill the bill. I'm trying to understand the concerns that you're trying to address.
No. What the really the big push, and they we talk about how the CCO would have a little bit different process for the eligibility, talking about the opt-in and the opt-out. The big difference in this bill is that it moves the federal poverty level from 138% to 250% for people that would qualify for oral health services. The concept behind that is veterans and seniors have not had oral health services available for them for a long time, so we have a backlog to get caught up. So we're bumping that up. It makes it equivalent to the folks that get oral health that have developmentally disabled. It matches the seniors and the veterans to that. We wanted to add pregnant women, but I didn't get that approval.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Hayden? Good. Okay, I've got Sabrina Briggs and Doug Barber signed up to testify. Ms. Riggs.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sabrina Riggs, and I am here representing the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon, also known as OPSO. I'm here to state OPSO's support for the A10 amendments. This amendment does not change the underlying language in House Bill 2834. Instead, it simply adds an additional section that takes the exact language from Senate Bill 963 and adds it in an additional section. As Senator Steiner Hayward did mention, Senate Bill 963 passed out of the Senate unanimously. Additionally, I would like to note that it did not receive any opposition during its public hearing in the House Health Care Committee. The A10 amendments seek to resolve a reimbursement issue that many DOs are facing with certain insurers. For those who might be unfamiliar with DOs, MDs and DOs are equivalent in their training and residency requirements, and DOs are fully licensed physicians. However, one way that MDs and DOs differ is that DOs receive training on how to provide osteopathic manipulative treatment, which is also known as OMT. OMT is a hands-on manipulation of the body and is a proven effective and non-invasive way for physicians to treat a patient's pain, often in lieu of opioids or other pain medication options. In fact, the HRC recommends OMT as an alternative to opioids to treat lower back pain, although OMT also has many other recognized purposes. So here's the problem that the amendment seeks to address. When a DO goes to treat a patient with OMT, they first have to decide, is this patient even a good candidate for it? And they do that through an evaluation of management, also known as an E&M, but even better known as an office visit. So once they do the office visit and determine that the patient is a good candidate, they then provide the OMT service. The problem really arises when the physician then bills the insurance for the services they've already provided. They bill for the E&M and the OMT separately using a -25 code modifier as required by the CPT code guidelines. Unfortunately, some insurance companies are refusing to pay physicians for the much more expensive E&M and are opting to only pay for the OMT. These insurance companies are often claiming that there's overlap between the two services. We've submitted a chart of the CPT codes and their descriptions as written testimony, which clearly states that OMT and E&M are distinct services and must be billed as such. This payment denial is a continual problem that has significant impact on patient care in this state. When payments are denied, a physician has very few options. They can either, one, go through a lengthy and time-consuming and expensive process to appeal the denial, two, ask the patient to come back and receive OMT on another day, prolonging their pain, or three, simply decide not to provide OMT anymore, reverting to just medication treatment options. All of these options have negative consequences for patients in this state. It makes no sense to deny or delay care to a patient, make them come back on a different day to receive this care. It doesn't make sense to deny covered treatment to a patient. And three, it really doesn't make sense to deny payment to a physician for a covered service. Additionally, I'd like to note that if a physician performs the evaluation of management and then prescribes an opioid, they are reimbursed fully for that evaluation. With the opioid abuse challenges that our state is facing, we should not be adding more barriers for patients and effective non-pharmacological pain management treatment options. Finally, I just want to emphasize that this amendment is not a coverage mandate. It simply says that an insurer cannot deny reimbursement for either OMT or E&M based solely on the fact that the two services occur on the same day. If there's actual error, fraud, or miscoding, the insurer still has an avenue to deal with this and deny reimbursement as necessary. I urge your support of the -810 amendments, and I'm happy to take questions if there are any.
I think most of us on this committee have heard about this bill already.
Yeah.
We're either on the Senate Health Committee, or we were in the Senate or the House Health Committee. So thank you. Any questions for Ms. Riggs? Mr. Barber.
Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of Willamette Dental to talk about the underlying bill. I've had some conversations with Representative Hayden about this bill, so I think I understand what he's trying to get at in terms of providing dental services to veterans and seniors with incomes below 250% of federal poverty. What is still confusing to us is, one, how many of these people are there? I've not seen any estimates yet about the number of veterans or seniors under 250, and exactly, especially with seniors, when you get into trying to understand their income versus their resources, it's complicated. And so because we haven't seen the number of an estimate of how many of them are, we haven't seen any cost estimate about what. I mean, Representative Hayden talked about where some revenues might come from, either from the Veterans Measure 96 money or general fund to cover the seniors. It would just be really helpful to see what those numbers look like. The other piece that's confusing to us is actually just in the wording of the bill. If you look in Section 2, which is kind of the heart of the dental piece of this, it says that on line 6, this is the first page, that the DCOs, dental care organizations, must provide oral health care services to these individuals. What it doesn't say is that OHA has to pay for them. We know that that's assumed. We don't believe that this was intended to be an unfunded mandate to cover thousands of people or tens of thousands of people. But we would feel better if someplace that it was actually clear that these people are expected to receive the dental benefits that are in the prioritized list and paid for by OHA or the CCO, however that needs to be clarified. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hayden.
I can address that a little bit. And thank you for your questions and your concerns. As far as the underlining bill, I think technically you're right that it doesn't spell that out. That was potentially on purpose, because when we wrote this way back when, trying to get the Oregon Department of Veterans Administration involved, which, by the way, they're very, very concerned about oral health. We didn't try and bring a bunch of vets in here and talk about this bill because it seems a little unstable, and I didn't want to put them in that position of just being have this ripped out from underneath them. So we're going to continue to fight for it. But it was intentional not to have the funding spelled out in the policy committee, because I was told, I was committed to, that that will be done in ways and means. So here we are having that discussion. So I think it's the appropriate time. It is way later than I expected to have this discussion, so it is really late in the session. But again, the intention is to have, if you want to call it a POP or a general fund appropriation for the funding of it. There is by no means an intention of the DCOs or the CCOs are just going to provide this service for free. I have tried repeatedly to get these numbers and to get LFO to do a fiscal on it, and I have been told repeatedly that has to come from four people in this building that all agree, and apparently those four people have not agreed to have that happen.
Okay.
comments, Mr. Barber, at all? Okay. Any other questions?
Look forward to seeing them.
Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2834. As I previously mentioned, we won't yet be working this bill because there are still some details to be worked out. If there's anybody else from the CCO, DCO land that wants to submit written testimony, we'd be interested in your perspective on this bill. Ms. Bushman-Reinhold, anything else you want to add?
No, thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Okay, and for the committee's information, Co-Chair Rayfield and I are requesting two additional meetings of the subcommittee this week, either at 1 o'clock on Tuesday and Thursday or 4:30 on Tuesday and Thursday, because that's about it for this committee this week. So we're trying to get that taken care of to make sure that we have the opportunity to hear all the bills, and so that bills that would be better heard in this committee don't end up in front of Capital Construction, which can be kind of awkward. Not that I'm dismissing the value of our colleagues on Capital Construction, just that they don't deal with this kind of bill as much. So anything else for the business of the good of the order? Okay, we're adjourned. The good of the order? Okay, we're adjourned. Anything else for the business?